the bottom line in business. Voice America Business.
Welcome to Three-Dimensional Wealth with Roe Diefendorf, your source for total wealth management. All comments, views, and opinions expressed on the show are solely those of Roe, his guests, and callers. Now let's begin the show. Here's your host, Roe Diefendorf.
Thank you for joining me on Three-Dimensional Wealth. I'm your host, Roe Diefendorf, and for the next hour, we're going to be talking about ESOPs Revisited. We've spent an hour at another time and went through some of the mechanics. But we wanted to come back and revisit it because it's a topic that I think is strategic for those privately held companies that are looking to transition to pass their stock. And so I have two experts with me. I have, again, Greg Sheets is from Charlotte, North Carolina. And also we have Sam Tropolopoulos. And say that three times fast. We're glad to have the two of you. Let me just set the stage so they know who the pros are that I've got on the line. Greg is president of Greg Sheets & Associates, and he's in Charlotte, just north of the city, and been in business now for over 20 years and in investments in financial services. He's a member of the prestigious Million Dollar Roundtable, and he has a close alliance with ATI Capital Group, of which Sam is the president. And they've done over 60 ESOP transactions since 1994, and they will value between, I think, 50 to 60 separate entities alone this year. So Greg is involved with them, and Sam is from Dallas, Texas. And Sam was active in an accounting field for 15 years prior to joining ATI Capital Group in August of 2000. He's now the president. Oversees the daily operations and the valuation engagements, and they do a full compliance with the Uniform Standards of Professional Appraisal Practices. He also has earned his designation of ABV, which is the highest business valuation designation offered by the American Institute of CPAs, and has completed the courses necessary to become a member of the American Society of Appraisers Accreditation and Business Appraisal Program. So, two pros to here to talk about ESOPs. Welcome to the two of you.
Thanks, Roy.
Thanks for having us.
Greg, I'm going to ask you to tee it up and take us out and give us an overview. Once again, you've done that well for us before, but an overview. What is an ESOP?
Roy, an ESOP is a qualified retirement plan. It's a defined contribution retirement plan. It's unique in that it must own primarily the stock of the sponsoring employer. It's a tool that we use to help folks transition their companies by either buying out existing shareholders, using the proceeds from the ESOP to acquire another company or to acquire capital goods, and to hopefully help them grow their share price.
I like the way that that you worded it when we were on before. You said it's the ultimate exit strategy tool, or how to sell your company stock and pay no tax. Of course, that was the soundbite that queued up everybody and said, all right, let's pay attention. Do me one more thing, Greg, is sort of walk us through the basic transition of the ESOP, if you will.
Sure. If we'll use the example of the exiting shareholder, and under this example we'll just call them mom and dad as an example. Let's say the mom and dad have put their lives into this business and they're desirous of retiring with the necessary capital to maintain their standard of living. They cannot afford to just give it to the children or just give it to the management team, and they want the company to continue and hopefully prosper going forward. They can either sell or finance the transaction and take back a note, or the company can go to lenders that are competent in ESOP lending. And let's say under this transaction they were to borrow $10 million. The company would borrow $10 million. The company then would loan at $10 million to the ESOP. The ESOP would take the cash, buy mom and dad stock for $10 million. The stock would be put into the ESOP. And as the company made its annual pension contribution into the ESOP, it would then, in turn, the ESOP would exchange that in exchange for stock to the company. The company would then pay the principal and interest to the lender and therefore be able to deduct the principal and interest of the assets necessary to acquire mom and dad stock. If mom and dad reinvest the $10 million of proceeds within 12 months into qualified replacement property, they can defer capital gains, hopefully forever or till such time that they were to liquidate or sell the qualified replacement property. So that's how you could borrow the money to purchase the stock. Mom and dad could avoid capital gains, and the company could repay the loan with pre-tax principal and interest deductible dollars.
Mm, sounds so good. Take me out. I'm ready. There's a phrase that you guys use, and I've heard Sam use it. He talks about business transfer channels. Business transfer channels. Sam, what does that mean?
Well, what that means is there are many ways in which a business can be transferred from one generation to the next. And there are different rules that we have to follow depending upon the transfer channel that the business owner chooses. So, for example, on an estate tax planning type of a transfer, we're all familiar with trusts and whether they're charitable or, you know, the grats and the gruts. Some people call it the alphabet soup. That transfer channel is going to, one, dictate the value, because the IRS is going to tell us the rules that we must follow in calculating the value, and two, it's going to effectuate certain things for the business owner which are important to him or her. Other transfer channels might be, for example, doing an IPO. So if the company is what we call a high flyer and is growing quickly and is in an industry that's high in demand and is going to continue to be that way for a while, then a transfer channel might be an IPO. Another transfer channel might be, we've all heard, LBOs or MBOs, management buyouts or leverage buyouts. So these happen quite often in both the public and the private world, but those are also considered to be transfer channels. So what's important when we're talking to a business owner is to be able to sit down with them and figure out what their motives are so that we can help them find the best transfer channel that is going to work based on their facts and circumstances. You know, one of the things that we tell business owners is that it's quite possible for your company to have multiple values on the same day, depending on which transfer channel you choose. Obviously, an IPO is going to have a different value than liquidating the assets and closing the doors. And so what's really important in that first step or that first meeting with the business owner is to really try to find out what their motives are and to be able to help them choose the best transfer channel based on their facts and circumstances.
So the answer might not be, I want to get the most amount of money out of this transfer, because it may not match up with his objectives. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct. I mean, oftentimes the legacy is important. They want the business to continue. They want to remain active and continue to work in the business. They want to help grow the business. But they want to have a different role going forward. And quite often, there's a certain level of financial security that's required in order for them to be able to do that. And so they look at different options depending upon the value of their company, the growth and the value of their company, and what their personal goals are, in addition to simply how much can I sell it for and what can I get.
So the way I kind of envision it, Sam, though, is, you know, you've got these transfer channels that are sort of internal and external. It's like putting on your pair of pants. You know, one goes down one route, you go external, and the other one goes down another route, it's internal. Is that the way you see it, or am I picturing that wrong?
No, that's correct. I mean, there, you know, for example, by default, many privately held businesses are not going to be candidates for IPOs, and this is especially true, you know, after Sarbanes-Oxley, after Enron, after all these things that have made it very expensive for corporations to be able to pay for the compliance necessary to be traded on a public exchange. One of the other things that certain business owners don't realize until it's too late, is that even if you do an IPO, you still may not have the liquidity or the ability to sell your stock in the public market, because there may not be enough interest in your stock to be able to support that market. And so, you know, you and the first fundamental decision, you're correct, is you know, are we going to do an internal or an external transfer? Now, on the external transfer side, in addition to the IPO, well, there's what's called private equity groups, and these are organizations that make investments in privately held businesses. They'll take a 70, 80% or even 100% ownership stake in the company. They will maybe infuse some capital. Let's say that the company has just developed a new product or has just received a patent, but the business owner doesn't want to spend the time and the money to develop that patent or that product or go to market with it, and he wants a financial buyer to come in and help him take his company to the next level. And in that case, what would happen is the private equity group would buy 80% of the stock. They might infuse some capital into the company, try to use the patent as leverage to grow the company, and then, but they're going to sell the company, or they're going to do an IPO, or they might roll it up with other privately held companies and sell it off to a larger publicly traded company. And so the thing that's important to remember on the external transfer side is that, you know, if you're using a private equity group, keep in mind that they have an exit strategy. And so your exit strategy needs to be consistent with what their exit strategy is going to be, because if it's not, you may find yourself a little disillusioned. Now, the only other option on the external transfer side would be to hire an investment banker, or more commonly what's known as a business broker, who will act as your representative to go out into the world and try to find a buyer. And that could be an individual, it could be a corporation, or it could be a private equity group. So the external transfer spectrum is a little bit more limited, because based on those three options that we've just discussed, not every corporation is ready, willing, and able to be able to take advantage of them. And so what ends up happening is that by default, a fair number of companies fall to the internal transfer side. And you already mentioned some of the reasons, you know, legacy. Maybe they want the business to continue. They want their children to be involved in the business. There's a whole host of reasons. They may have partners. So a very common scenario is buy-sell. We have two partners that are willing to buy and sell the stock amongst themselves because they're already partners in the business. And so the gamut of possible internal transfers is a lot broader than it is on the external side.
So would you use an ESOP only for the internal transfers, or is that a tool that can be used also in the external transfers?
Well, that's an excellent question. The financial world is becoming more and more sophisticated each and every day. I don't know if you've seen in the Chicago Tribune story with Sam Zell. He's proposed to take over the Tribune and do so with an S corporation ESOP. Furthermore, there are companies out there like Avis and United that were publicly traded companies that had ESOPs. And so it's much more common on the internal side for the ESOP to be an option, but it certainly is something that's being looked at more and more because of the tax advantages that we discuss this afternoon, some of which Greg's already elaborated on. It really makes it wide open, so to speak, but primarily it's an internal transfer kind of a strategy.
And I would assume, though, that if you were really trying to, you know, hit the long ball and get the maximum bang for the buck, that you'd try to go for an external transfer. Am I safe to say that?
That's the conventional wisdom, yes. But the question is your company going to be attractive? Is it capable of effectuating those kinds of transactions? And generally we're looking at, you know, companies that are generating what's called economic value added. I mean, are they growing more quickly than the cost of inflation and taxes? Is the company's return on equity significantly higher than the economy and or the industry in which they operate? And so by definition, you know, everybody wants to do an external transfer, but at the end of the day, many business owners haven't prepared their company for an external transfer.
Okay. Well, we're going to take a short break. So Greg, Sam, stay tuned. Listeners, stay tuned, because we'll be back with more Three Dimensional Wealth.
Online in Business. Voice America Business.
Going nowhere as a financial professional? Enroll today at the American College. The American College is the nation's oldest and largest distance learning institution devoted to financial services education. Research has shown that graduates of the American College's Chartered Life Underwriter and Chartered Financial Consultant programs average 20% higher production income than their peers without professional designations. For more information, visit theamericancollege.edu. That's theamericancollege.edu, the education you need to succeed.
Financial planning can be confusing and complex, and unless you have a solid game plan, you could be taking unnecessary risks and missing out on tremendous opportunities. Let Diefendorf Capital Planning Associates take the mystery out of investing and help you build a solid financial foundation for years to come. Diefendorf Capital Planning revolves around the family, and through our financial service companies and three-dimensional wealth centers, we strive to deliver total wealth management, financially, personally, and socially. Learn more about what Diefendorf Capital Planning Associates can do for you. Visit the website at diefendorfcapital.com today. Integrity, full service, best in class, diefendorfcapital.com.
Investment management is more than picking a good stock. In fact, a good company may not be a good investment. With today's complex financial products, it becomes critical to employ a true professional on your team. That's where the members of IMCA, the Investment Management Consultants Association, comes in. These professionals have proven themselves to be the best in the business. So when looking to get a second opinion on your portfolio, look for individuals with a CIMA designation. That's Certified Investment Management Analyst, a cut above the rest. Brought to you by the NYC chapter of IMCA.
The Internet's only all business and financial radio network, Voice America Business.
Bringing you the keys to total wealth management, this is Three-Dimensional Wealth with Roey Diefendorf. Comments or questions? Visit www.diefendorfcapital.com or call 516-759-3900. Now back to the show. Here's Roey Diefendorf.
I'm here with Sam Torolopoulos and Greg Sheets. We're talking about ESOPs. And before our break, we were talking about these business transfer channels, and you could transfer your business either through internal to your employees or your family, and then external and taking it out to the public marketplace. The one thing I wanted to ask you, though, either Sam or Greg, is if you do an ESOP internally, does that then take sort of the external option off the table? I mean, so you've done one, and that's the end of the day?
Well, that's an excellent question, and the answer is absolutely not. What happens is, and what I tell a lot of business owners is that, you know, a corporation, much like an individual, has a life cycle. And the ESOP can be something that helps the company go from one phase of its life cycle or business cycle into another. And so one of the things that's important to understand with ESOPs, for example, is that you're not required to have an ESOP forever. So in other words, you know, a corporation could start an ESOP today, and for some reason, if there's an IPO or if a private equity group were to come along and buy the company, the new owner would have the option of either keeping or terminating the ESOP. And so looking at tax advantages, structure, growth, all kinds of issues that are going to be critical for the company have to be examined as well. So not only is it the motives of the owner of the business, but it's also, you know, where is the company going and what opportunities lie before the company and what's the most tax advantage way for the company to get there. Let me give you a quick example. We worked with a client for several years that had an ESOP, and in fact the ESOP was 100% shareholder. And the management team had a what's called a change in control provision in their compensation package that basically said if somebody ever comes and buys the company for more than the ESOP price, the management team will share in the delta, meaning the difference between the offering price and the ESOP valuation price. Well, they were able to grow the company substantially because of the tax advantages of an ESOP, and just last year, a private equity group came and bought the company. And so the employees were paid handsomely in their retirement accounts because the shares were bought for more than the fair market value. The management team got what's called a change in control bonus, so they shared handsomely, and and they were compensated for their foregoing of ownership during the period of time in which the ESOP owned it all. And so, again, an ESOP, for example, is a phase that the company can go through, but by no means are there any rules or requirements to say that the ESOP must remain in place forever.
Mm-hmm. Well, these external transfers obviously are not for everyone. So let's go just wind back a little bit and just talk about how privately held companies and publicly traded companies act differently.
Okay. Yeah, that's an excellent question, and this is something that I've kind of noticed in my years of practice, and I kind of akin it to what I call truths in business. There are certain undeniable truths in business in the way that privately held businesses act versus publicly traded companies act. And here's a couple of quick examples. For example, a publicly traded company could care less about income taxes. Their goal is to make as big of a profit as possible, to pay as large of a dividend as possible, and to be able to have calls with analysts that are going to show that their stock price is going to increase. But a privately held business, on the other hand, and the business owner, are keenly aware of income taxes and the cost that it has to the company. Why? Because the second truth in business is that privately held businesses have limited access to capital. And every business owner knows and understands this, because every time they try to expand or grow the company, they are forced to go out and get a loan. And the amount of the loan that they're able to get is predicated on their ability to give a personal guarantee. Unlike Microsoft, for example, that has access to capital, and the goal of the CFO is to keep the cost of that capital as low as possible. So if Microsoft needs money, what do? They issue more stock, they do a bond offering, or they go to some other form of capital that a privately held business would never really ever have access to. And so that difference really causes those two structures to act differently. The privately held business owner tends to be functional versus strategic, meaning he spends more time working in the business than working on the business.
Mm-hmm.
He's keenly aware of taxes. And then he's also more concerned about developing his personal wealth, whereas the CEO of a publicly traded company knows that his personal wealth can only increase through growing stock price. And so there's a whole different attitude about the way that businesses run and the way decisions are made when the executives know that they can have, quote-unquote, unlimited access to capital. And one of the other misnomers out there is that not every publicly traded company immediately has unlimited access to capital. There are a lot of very small publicly traded companies that don't enjoy the liquidity and access to capital that a Microsoft or an IBM or an Archer Daniels Midland might have available to it.
Can we talk about the private capital markets? You touched on a little bit about having access to capital, but maybe sort of the status of private capital markets today?
Yeah, the economy tends to go in 10-year cycles, and if we think back, you know, all the way back to the 1970s, and even, you know, 1970, 71, 1980, 81, 82, those were all down years in the market, even 1990, 91, and again 2000, 2001. So the economy tends to go in those 10-year cycles, and what happens is, you know, just as we see in the broader markets, those cycles expand and contract. And so we have some interesting dynamics that are going on today. One, the globalization of the economy. Two, the aging of the baby boomers. Three, the timing of the 10-year cycle. Four, outsourcing. You know, China, India. All of these things are happening. And for the first time in 2010, 2011, we think that all of these cycles and markets are going to be coming together and kind of converging, and there's a fear out there that the downturn is going to be a little bit steeper and a little bit longer than we've seen either in 1990 or 2000, 2001. And so the current status of the private capital markets is very good. I mean, the economy's been doing well. We've seen this on all of the financial channels. Companies are trading at very large multiples, record profits quarter after quarter. But what's different this time is that there's not an exuberance in the marketplace like there was in the 1990s. You know, the tech bubble that everybody talks about resulted from publicly traded companies and private equity groups paying outrageous multiples just to acquire a privately held company that was the next dot-com craze. Well, that's not happening this time. And so what's happening is that all of these entities, whether it's a publicly traded company or a private equity group, they're still making strategic acquisitions of privately held businesses, but they're not paying exuberant multiples. So the business owner that was waiting around thinking, well, I'll just wait for the next upswing in the economy, you know, maybe this time he's in his mid-60s or maybe even his mid-70s, he's not seeing the kinds of multiples that he had hoped for. So what's happening from our perspective is that internal transfers are becoming very popular again because there's no longer a holding out for an unrealistic sale of your company to a private equity group or to a publicly traded company that's going to pay you, you know, 18 times earnings when the marketplace is really only willing to pay 7 times earnings or 8 times earnings.
Greg, you're in the trenches like I am. We're practitioners out there doing it. And one of the things I want to ask you is as you're out there, you know, how do the client's motives alter your approach? Again, you're on three-dimensional wealth, so, I mean, as we talked about, Sam was saying that, you know, personal wealth becomes an important part of maybe a privately held business or social wealth. But how does that help you to change what you're dealing with or adapt?
You know, Roey, we typically compete with what we call folks that want a walk-away deal. Mm-hmm. They've worked hard and they're desirous of selling their company and they struggle with what does it look like going forward. And the client who is wanting to take the bag of money and walk away, pay taxes and retire is a different client than one who is desirous of transitioning the business to their children or to the management who wants to continue the legacy that they've, you know, built for their whole lives. So we really quickly try to establish what are you interested in doing, and if the person is desirous of cashing out and really doesn't want to the responsibility of the direction of the company going forward, then that dictates a certain type of channel that we would recommend. Mm-hmm. However, that person who we tend to find more of, the small business owner that is not desirous of going public or is not big enough to go public or doesn't consider that, we think if you were desirous of going public, you have to be rather large. You have to be able to handle the cost and complexities of Sarbanes-Oxley and such. But that, you know, that $10, $20, $100, $200 million closely held company who has children in the business, that dictates another channel that we would help them with, and we'll talk about that after the break if you'd like.
All right. We will come back to that. So we're going to take a short break, but we'll be back with more three-dimensional wealth, so stay tuned.
The bottom line in business. Voice America Business.
Investment management is more than picking a good stock. In fact, a good company may not be a good investment. With today's complex financial products, it becomes critical to employ a true professional on your team. That's where the members of IMCA, the Investment Management Consultants Association, comes in. These professionals have proven themselves to be the best in the business. So when looking to get a second opinion on your portfolio, look for individuals with a CIMA designation. That's Certified Investment Management Analyst, a cut above the rest. Brought to you by the NYC chapter of IMCA.
Going nowhere as a financial professional? Enroll today at the American College. The American College is the nation's oldest and largest distance learning institution devoted to financial services education. Research has shown that graduates of the American College's Chartered Life Underwriter and Chartered Financial Consultant programs average 20% higher production income than their peers without professional designations. For more information, visit theamericancollege.edu. That's theamericancollege.edu, the education you need to succeed.
Financial planning can be confusing and complex, and unless you have a solid game plan, you could be taking unnecessary risks and missing out on tremendous opportunities. Let Diefendorf Capital Planning Associates take the mystery out of investing and help you build a solid financial foundation for years to come. Diefendorf Capital Planning revolves around the family, and through our financial service companies and three-dimensional wealth centers, we strive to deliver total wealth management, financially, personally, and socially. Learn more about what Diefendorf Capital Planning Associates can do for you. Visit the website at diefendorfcapital.com today. Integrity, full service, best in class, diefendorfcapital.com.
The Internet's only all business and financial radio network, Voice America Business.
We now return to Three-Dimensional Wealth with Rory Diefendorf. Direct your questions and comments to www.diefendorfcapital.com or call 516-759-3900. Now the host of Three-Dimensional Wealth, Rory Diefendorf.
Welcome back. My guests for today are Greg Sheets and we have Sam Torlopoulos. And we're going to talk about valuation, business valuations, because that's a key part of ESOPs that we've been discussing. And Sam, when I look at all the things that you've got and your designations, you've got the ABV, which is a business valuation designation offered through the AICPA.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're also a member of the American Society of Appraisers.
Right.
And Accreditation Business Appraisal Programs. So maybe you could lead us out and outline the business valuation process.
Okay. Well, the premise, you know, that's important to kind of understand as the foundation of what we're going to talk about is that, you know, because our privately held business owner clients don't have their stock traded on the New York Stock Exchange, generally speaking, they really don't have a grasp of what the value of their company is. Intuitively, they know what it's worth based on their profits, but they don't really know how a buyer would go about looking at their company and determining what they would be willing to pay them for it. And so as a predicate to any planning process, we have to have a benchmark. We have to have a way of measuring what we think that company can sell for, either in the open market by a publicly traded company or what a private equity group might be willing to pay, or what we what we might have to use as far as valuation procedures if we're going to do an internal transfer via an estate plan. And so, you know, one of the other truths in business I tell my clients is that you can't increase the value of your company if you don't know what the value of your company is. And so one of the things that we do when we do a valuation that's a little bit unique is I try to bring what I call value added to the table, and I try to show my clients some of the things that they're doing that are causing the value of their company to go up and some of the things that they're doing that might cause the value of their company to go down. And we work with them to help them improve upon those things that they're doing that help it go up and show them ways to minimize some of the things that they might be doing inadvertently, of course, to make the value go down. And so no matter what, when I'm engaged to work with an attorney or if I'm engaged by a business owner to begin to help them with this process, I call it the corporate transition strategy process, the first step is either a feasibility study or a valuation. And as I think I might have mentioned earlier in the program that, you know, a privately held business can have multiple values on the same day. And business owners sometimes may have a little trouble grasping that. But the fact of the matter is if they liquidate their assets and close the doors, that's going to be a much different number than if they actively seek in the marketplace to be able to sell the company. And so we take a look at all the factors that will help them move from one value conclusion to the next value conclusion. One of the other things that's critical that we always talk about when I'm talking to a business owner about value is there's a difference between a control versus a minority price. You know, if I'm going to invest in your company and I'm only going to be 25% shareholder, I'm going to look at that investment a whole lot differently than if I'm going to be able to be in control. Why? Because if I can put myself in control, I can do all the things that the current owner is doing. I can determine who my officers are going to be. I can determine who the directors are going to be. I can determine what direction the company is going to go in the future. I can decide compensation issues. I can decide whether or not stock-based incentive plans are going to be put into the company. I can't do any of those things if I'm the minority shareholder. If I'm the minority shareholder, my two biggest concerns are, when do I get a dividend or a return on my investment, or how quickly can I sell this stock should I decide that you're not running the company in a manner in which I want to continue as a minority shareholder. And so the discount for a lack of control and based on the fact that the company's not publicly traded can have a material difference on the value of the company. And so when we go through this process, for state tax planning purposes, for example, the business owner may be desirous of a lower value. So we might do a structure, or we might put together a transaction that might be based on a minority valuation as opposed to a control valuation. And so we have to play all these things out, and we really can't properly advise the business owner unless there's a baseline for which we can point to. And that's the purpose of the business valuation, is to create that baseline, go through the process methodically, show the business owner what his options are, and how those different transfer channels, which are predicated by their motives, are going to affect the value of their company. You know, I can't tell you how many times I've had a business owner say, "Oh, you think my company's worth $10 million? That's crazy. I had 15 offers to sell my company for $30 million just in the last 6 months." And, of course, my question is, well, were any of them in writing? And, of course, there's silence. And so, you know, we really have to be careful when we're dealing with a privately held business that doesn't trade its stock on a stock exchange. What is value? How is it measured? And how do we affect the value of a company?
Now, in these transactions, the ESOP transactions,
mm-hmm.
Greg, how important is this valuation process?
Well, it's critical because when we're doing a valuation for either state tax purposes or ESOP purposes, the Internal Revenue Service and or the Department of Labor will dictate how and what procedures we use to calculate that value. And so the good part of it is that the business owner knows before entering into the transaction what the value of the company is. But the quote unquote not so good side of that is there's no, you know, what if I could sell the company for more? And so you have to understand, and the business owner has to understand that we have certain rules that we have to follow for state tax valuations and certain rules that we have to follow for ESOP valuation purposes. But those rules are very similar to each other. And if the work is done properly, it gives a pretty clear and true indication of what the company is worth in the marketplace.
But there are some techniques that you can do to recast the financial statement for these valuation purposes, correct?
That's correct. And again, that's one of the issues of control. For example, we can add back compensation. We can add back certain things into the income stream, which will cause the value to go up if we're doing a control valuation. And so this is especially true with respect to an ESOP transaction, because oftentimes the management team, even if the management team consists of former shareholders, they'll have employment agreements, they'll have management agreements. And so if we can reasonably determine what the income stream is going to be going forward, and by discounting the present value of that future income stream, we can capture that in the valuation for ESOP purposes. So a lot of business owners say to me, "Well, you know, I don't want to sell my stock to an ESOP because it's going to go up in value, and therefore I won't be paid for that value." Well, my answer to that is if we use the present value of the future cash flows approach to calculating value, then we will be capturing that value in the company.
Discounts, stacking discounts, double discounts. What are those terminology? How do they tie into the valuation process?
Well, those concepts are all out of the estate tax planning side. As I alluded to earlier, there are certain instances in which a taxpayer, for estate tax purposes, might want to have the value of his company be as low as possible because it's easier to get out of his estate. And so there have been structures and strategies that have been put forth by estate planning attorneys over the years that allow for, you know, discounts, stacking discounts. Let me give you an example of a stacking discount. If you take a minority block of your privately held company and put it into a family limited partnership or an LLC, and then you gift a minority interest in that LLC to a trust for the benefit of your children, then the theory is that there's a level of discounts taken at the stock level for the privately held operating company, and another series of discounts that are taken at the FLP or LLC level when they're transferred into the trust for the benefit of the children. Another option that's used more often is, for example, a privately held company stock can be reclassified into voting and non-voting stock. And there have been studies done that say that non-voting shares are not quite as valuable as voting shares. And so you can theoretically get another layer of discounts by converting your company into voting and non-voting stock, and then you would begin making transfers either via gift or sale to your children of the non-voting shares.
When you do the ESOP, right, and now you've pegged this, or you've made the valuation based on a certain set of assumptions in this valuation process, does that peg it? And now when you go and die, I mean, now you have to live by the rules that you just established, or can you get the reevaluate it at death then for estate taxes? Can you get it both ways?
Well, one of the things that's important to understand about ESOPs is that you're not required to sell 100% of your stock to the ESOP. And so what many business owners do is they'll sell 30 or 40% of the stock to the ESOP. But once an ESOP is in place, the Department of Labor requires that the stock in the ESOP be valued each and every year. And so the business owner has an opportunity every year thereafter to decide whether or not he or she wants to sell more stock to the ESOP. And so what happens is that the ESOP presents a process to the business owner as opposed to an event. It gives them the opportunity to say, you know what, I'm going to sell some of my stock today at $10 a share, and maybe in 5 years when I turn 60, I'll sell, you know, another block of stock, and hopefully it'll be worth $12 a share or $13 a share. But then when I retire, when I turn the reins over to the management team, including the children that may or may not be in the business, I'll sell the balance of the stock then, and hopefully it'll be worth $17 or $18 a share. And so estate tax planning and ESOPs kind of go hand in hand. All of the work that we do with an ESOP does not take away the need to do estate tax planning. In fact, it enhances it, because what we're doing is we're taking that illiquid asset that's 80% of their estate, and we're turning it into a liquid asset.
Mm.
But it's still in their estate.
When you're doing these valuations annually, is there such a thing as a watered-down appraisal or evaluation? Or do you have to do a full-blown every year?
We have to do a full. The Department of Labor requires that a full-blown appraisal be done every year for the ESOP shares only.
All right. So when you're in it, you got to do it the whole thing. All right. We're going to take one more break before we come back for our last session, so stay tuned. We'll be back. Thanks.
The Bottom Line in Business. Voice America Business.
Going nowhere as a financial professional? Enroll today at the American College. The American College is the nation's oldest and largest distance learning institution devoted to financial services education. Research has shown that graduates of the American College's Chartered Life Underwriter and Chartered Financial Consultant programs average 20% higher production income than their peers without professional designations. For more information, visit theamericancollege.edu. That's theamericancollege.edu, the education you need to succeed.
Financial planning can be confusing and complex, and unless you have a solid game plan, you could be taking unnecessary risks and missing out on tremendous opportunities. Let Diefendorf Capital Planning Associates take the mystery out of investing and help you build a solid financial foundation for years to come. Diefendorf Capital Planning revolves around the family, and through our financial service companies and three-dimensional wealth centers, we strive to deliver total wealth management financially, personally, and socially. Learn more about what Diefendorf Capital Planning Associates can do for you. Visit the website at diefendorfcapital.com today. Integrity, full service, best in class, diefendorfcapital.com.
Investment management is more than picking a good stock. In fact, a good company may not be a good investment. With today's complex financial products, it becomes critical to employ a true professional on your team. That's where the members of IMCA, the Investment Management Consultants Association, comes in. These professionals have proven themselves to be the best in the business. So when looking to get a second opinion on your portfolio, look for individuals with a CIMA designation. That's Certified Investment Management Analyst, a cut above the rest. Brought to you by the NYC chapter of IMCA.
The Internet's only all business and financial radio network, Voice America Business.
Bringing you the keys to total wealth management, this is Three Dimensional Wealth with Roe Diefendorf. Comments or questions? Visit www.diefendorfcapital.com or call 516-759-3900. Now back to the show. Here's Roe Diefendorf.
I'm here with two ESOP wizards, and I have Sam Torlopoulos. We just call him Sammy T. And we have Greg Sheets. And I want to talk about, I have a Wall Street Journal article in front of me. This was from January 22nd of 2007. It says, Inside Eileen Fisher's Employee Stock Plan. Eileen Fisher, the New York clothing designer, faced a dilemma common to the growing number of baby boomer entrepreneurs pondering the future of companies they've built from scratch, how to cash out some of her closely held company and diversify her holdings. So last fall, she found the solution. She set up an employee stock ownership plan. Greg, maybe tell us about the story, because I know you know it pretty well.
This is a classic example of a prospect for us who fits the criteria textbook that we're looking for. Her company was very successful, about 624 employees. It had grown rapidly. It was all closely held. There wasn't a public market for this stock. Obviously, as Sam mentioned earlier, folks are typically not desirous of purchasing minority blocks of stock in closely held companies for the reasons that we talked about earlier. And she was able to sell 30% of her stock, or 31% of her stock, a minority block, for $30 million. She established basically her family's liquidity needs, most likely in perpetuity. She had children that were rather young, in their teens. And so she took a block of stock, sold it, took an amount of money off the table to diversify her portfolio in a manner that her family was going to be taken care of regardless of the success of her company going forward. However, she retained 70 or 69% of the company and could participate in the upside if the company continued to flourish going forward. I think she was very concerned about her three-dimensional wealth, and that this program not only benefited her and her family, but the 624 employees now had skin in the game. They had a reason to help the company grow and be successful, and had a close tie to the company as far as having ownership in the company. So she was able to do a number of things, and as we mentioned earlier, this didn't preclude her from considering the other options as the company matures and goes down the road and the cycles that it's going to face going forward. So it was a way for her to take a bag of money off the table, take care of her family, benefit the employees, allow her to explore her other philanthropic endeavors, as well as give the employees something that they could feel good about going forward as well.
Michael Gerber of the E-Myth fame, he says, you start your business to one day sell it. And the ESOP just, to me, sounds like the ideal tool to accomplish this objective. But, Sam, let me ask you this.
Mm-hmm.
What can go wrong?
Well,
can't all be that good.
Okay. Well, first of all, it's important to understand that, you know, ESOPs are not for everybody, and it's not for every corporation. And so one of the things that can go wrong is you can be put into an ESOP when really you shouldn't be an ESOP corporation. And that's a function of not doing proper due diligence up front. And so, but for those companies where it is a fit.
Now, is that a function of size primarily?
Well, it's not only size, but it's the composition of your balance sheet. How much debt do you have on the books? Are you in an industry that's expanding or contracting? Are you desirous of you know, having your employees have a stake in the company? Do you want this to be a process, not an event? Because some people, they want to sell their company and they want to be able to walk away. And so to them, an ESOP is not even an option, although financially it may be the perfect thing for the company. But if it doesn't fit the motives of the owner and it doesn't mesh with what it is that the owner wants to do for the next phase of his life, it's just not going to work. And so the first, you know, disaster is, you know, putting the proverbial square peg in a round hole. And we don't do that. And that's the purpose of the feasibility study. One, to determine if this is an option for them, and to really give me an opportunity to ask some of the tough questions, to find out what their motives really are. Another thing that could go wrong, if it's not properly communicated to the employees and they don't understand what the stake in the future is for them, they may not see that as being a positive thing. And I'll give you an example. We had a gentleman who was really excited about doing an ESOP, and he ESOPed his company. But when he made the announcement to his employees, you know, they didn't want to have anything to do with it. So they weren't properly brought in at the right time and made aware of what was happening. And as a result of that, he lost several key employees, and we had to unwind the ESOP, which was very painful because the gentleman, he so wanted to help his employees, he was even willing to and had sold the stock for less than what it was worth. And even doing that, you know, it wasn't something that the employees really appreciated or really understood. So you got to have proper motivations at the shareholder level. You have to have a good understanding, working knowledge, and buy-in by the employees. If you don't have both of those things, it's going to go wrong eventually.
Reminds me of the dog food company. There was this dog food company, and so they manufactured. They found out what was going to be best for the teeth, the coat, the bones, everything, and so they manufactured all this silos full of dog food. There was only one trouble. Dogs didn't like the taste.
Exactly.
so you can create this ESOP, but if the employees, if you're going to try and transition it over, don't like the taste, that's going to be a problem.
Yeah, they have to be willing to accept more responsibility. They've got to be willing to step up to the plate, so to speak, and take on a much more in-depth role. And as a result of that, you know, I tell business owners that there's three groups of people that we have to motivate. We have to motivate the selling shareholder, and the tax code does a great job of that. Mm-hmm. Greg already talked about how the seller can sell his stock to an ESOP and defer the capital gains tax. He already briefly alluded to and probably talked at length in the prior discussion about how the corporation gets an income tax deduction for this qualified plan being the buyer of the stock. And so there's a good motivation at the shareholder level. There's good motivation at the employee level. But it doesn't do a really – ESOPs don't do a really good job of motivating the management team that's going to be taking over. And so what I'm often finding in the transactions that I work in, especially those that are slightly larger, and I don't know if you noticed this or not, but I never talk about small companies. I talk about privately held companies.
Mm-hmm.
But for the mid-market privately held companies, there needs to be additional planning for the management team taking over. What's in it for them? And so often we will weave in there stock-based incentive plans or executive compensation plans that say, look, we acknowledge that you're going to be taking on a greater role and that you're only going to be one of 300 participants in the ESOP. So therefore, by being the president and taking on that role, one, you're going to have a salary increase, and two, you're going to have the opportunity to earn equity, either actual or synthetic, outside the ESOP. And so now what we've done through combination planning is we've created a scenario that motivates all three levels of employees: selling shareholder, executive team taking over, as well as the rank and file employee.
One thing I like working, you know, with Diefendorf Capital with ATI is, you know, as the quarterbacks, and that's how I see you, as the quarterbacks for this whole turnkey ESOP solution. And that's really what it's coming down to now.
Well, and it's such a complicated area. It's become a specialty within a specialty, and you're right. I mean, first of all, it takes a team to get the job done. One of the things that's critical, especially post-Enron, is that we have to have proper representation of both the buyer and the seller. And so a seasoned trustee, a good quality ERISA attorney, and a good quality independent financial advisor to the trustee, i.e. a good valuator, are critical to the success of an ESOP transaction. And so,
all right. We're just about done, but ATI Capital, it's got an office in Huntersville. It's got one in Irvine, Texas.
Yes.
What's the website that we can get to?
www.aticg.com.
All right. Greg, thanks a lot for being on the show. Sam, thank you again for all that you are adding to our whole three-dimensional wealth approach here.
Well, I thank you for the time. It was a pleasure.
All
thanks,
right.
Roy.
Good, and I hope you've enjoyed listening today. And I invite you to join me next week at the same time with more of Three-Dimensional Wealth. Thank you.
Voice America Business thanks you for tuning in to Three-Dimensional Wealth with Rory Diefenbach. Please join us again next Monday at 2 p.m. Pacific Time for more tips and strategies for achieving total wealth management on Three-Dimensional Wealth, right here on Voice America Business, the bottom line in business talk.